From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Here and Now. President Trump today tweeted, military solutions are now fully in place, locked and loaded should North Korea act unwisely. Hopefully, Kim Jong-un will find another path. Well, that other path could involve back-channel negotiations between the United States and North Korea, which, according to the Associated Press, have been going on for months. The president has also been attacking Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell on Twitter, blaming McConnell for failing to repeal the Affordable Care Act.
So lots to talk about in our Friday Politics Roundtable. And joining us today, Chad Pergram, who covers Congress for Fox News. Hi, Chad.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. And Jeff Bennett, who covers the White House for NPR. Hi, Jeff.
Hey there.
And let's start with what's happening with North Korea. We mentioned that tweet the president sent out this morning. Yesterday, President Trump referenced his statement earlier in the week threatening North Korean leaders with fire and fury like the world has never seen. Let's listen.
It's about time that somebody stuck up for the people of this country and for the people of other countries. So if anything, maybe that statement wasn't tough enough.
Asked what would be tougher than fire and fury, Trump said, you'll see. Jeff, what are people saying about how he's handling this? Because we've heard diplomats say he's maybe harming the prospects for dialogue in the future and that he is being reckless with his words.
I think what's concerning to some people is the lack of process, the apparent lack of process of strategy leading up to some of these declarations that we've seen from the president on Twitter and yesterday when he was speaking to members of the press pool. But the point the president makes is that, you know, as he said in that piece of tape you just played, he's really pessimistic about finding a diplomatic solution to the North Korean threat because, as he points out, the attempts by former presidents Clinton, Bush and Obama have all been ineffective and North Korea's nuclear arsenal has grown unabated. And so that's essentially what we're seeing here. And people close to the president say that his statements are meant to convey strength, that having sort of this really tough rhetoric is the thing that might make the difference.
Chad, what are you hearing? I know that the lawmakers are not around you as they usually are because they're back in their districts. But what are you hearing from people on Capitol Hill about how President Trump is handling this?
Well, this would have a completely different tincture if Congress were in session because you would be having briefings and so on and so forth. Members of Congress would be forced to weigh in on what the president's rhetoric has been. And also they would be forced to comment on, are you for attacking North Korea? Are you for attacking them preemptively or something along those lines? Congress conveniently is away right now in the 5-week August recess, and they're not being staked out at every outpost here on Capitol Hill by reporters like myself. And that's where, you know, they're getting a pass. There are some Republicans, obviously, who don't like the bellicose rhetoric by the president. I got a statement here from David Cicilline, a Democratic congressman from Rhode Island, who has written to House Speaker Paul Ryan, and he has asked for the speaker to recall the Congress to debate legislation prohibiting a preemptive nuclear strike. In other words, if they're going to do something ahead of time without the blessing of Congress, Congressman Cicilline believes that Congress should be here and weigh in on that. And again, this is the war powers that's afforded the Congress in the Constitution. People would want to have a say here on Capitol Hill.
Oh, interesting. Well, but Chad, if I could just follow up with that with you for a second, because on the other hand, the supporters of the president are saying that perhaps there isn't anything out of step or out of line with President Trump's rhetoric. I mean, past presidents, including Bill Clinton, have used some strong language on North Korea. And at the same time, the supporters of the president say that those past presidents didn't do enough to stop North Korea.
A good litmus test for this is the non-voting delegate to the House of Representatives, Madeleine Bordalio from Guam. I noticed a very gradual turn in her phrasing in three statements that she's put out. When this started to ramp up around Tuesday, she put out a statement saying she was concerned and said she thought that Guam was protected. Then she put out a statement about 12 hours later saying she was concerned about the president's rhetoric. And after the bellicose rhetoric yesterday, she hit him again and said, stop it, back it down. And that's the very interesting thing here. Obviously, she does not have a vote. There are 6 non-voting delegates to Congress here and couldn't vote on a war or any sort of authorization to hit North Korea. But she's very concerned about the 165,000 people who she represents. And they appear to be, you know, first in line here if something were to break out.
And there is one aspect here that could bring down the temperature a little bit. I think Jeremy spoke to this earlier. And we know that the AP is reporting today that the Trump administration has been engaging in back-channel diplomacy with North Korea for the past several months. And NPR actually reported earlier this summer, I believe it was, that Joseph Yoon, who's the U.S. envoy for North Korea policy, was involved in talks in Europe to find a way to have some of the jailed Americans who were in North Korea released, and that he was involved in bringing home Otto Warmbier. So that's one element that could find, you know, hopefully some success in sort of ratcheting down the rhetoric.
All right, and if I could just jump back in here real quick here. One thing, you know, that was said about Warmbier is how he was returned. That didn't exactly impress a lot of people on Capitol Hill, the fact that this guy got very sick, was in a coma, and basically returned home to Cincinnati and died a couple of days later. The other thing I should flag is that the question whether or not they're actually debating North Korea per se is going to come up immediately in September. Mm. The Senate, right before they went on recess at the end of last week, was looking at debating the defense authorization bill. And there's a host of amendments which are now being drafted to deal specifically with North Korea. And so whether they're debating an actual authorization to fight against North Korea, you know, goes by the wayside. They are going to be talking about North Korea on the Senate floor in September.
Well, the Senate is led right now by Mitch McConnell. So let's talk about what's going on there. The president has traded some less than friendly words with McConnell. On Monday, McConnell gave a speech saying Trump's lack of experience in politics led him to push Obamacare repeal and replace too fast. Trump attacked him in tweets all week. And yesterday, the president was asked if he thought McConnell should resign. Here's what he had to say about that.
Well, I'll tell you what, if he doesn't get repeal and replace done, and if he doesn't get taxes done, meaning cuts and reform, and if he doesn't get a very easy one to get done, infrastructure, if he doesn't get them done, then you can ask me that question.
Chad, what do you make of this?
Well, this is very strange because in addition to that defense bill, when Congress comes back to session in September, they have to raise the debt ceiling. They have to keep the government open. They probably have to deal with, in some form, these health care cost-sharing payments, which the deadline comes up for that on the 21st. And Mitch McConnell is the one person on Capitol Hill who has given President Trump his solitary legislative victory. That was changing the Senate precedent to confirm Neil Gorsuch to the Supreme Court. And so people are saying, wait a minute, you have these big crises coming down the pike in September. Why are you beating up Mitch McConnell? And there was a little bit of some fallout for the way Mitch McConnell handled the health care bill, even among members of his own conference. He definitely has dipped to his lowest ebb. But when you start to have the president beating up Mitch McConnell, who is generally in very good stead with his membership, this is privately infuriating Republican senators.
Chad makes a great point. He knows the Hill better than most. And I would just add that this sort of one-sided feud does nothing to change the legislative landscape facing Republicans when they come back to the Hill in September. And I think what this is a president who really is the head of the Republican Party, but who has approval ratings at historic lows, who's trying to shift the blame here and cast himself as an outsider taking on the Republican establishment. It is a role that did very well for him during the campaign. I think we're seeing him return to that.
And another thing here, too, is that this is an opportunity for the president to create a foil. He's the president.
Right.
Even though there's Republicans in Congress running the House and running the Senate, he's able to beat up Congress, his favorite whipping boy, by taking on Mitch McConnell and saying, well, those do-nothing people on Capitol Hill, what's the problem with them?
Sometimes, a lot of times, and this is one of them, I feel like we're getting mixed signals, though, from the president, right? Because the president did endorse the establishment Republican backed by Mitch McConnell.
Great point,
in Alabama over two conservatives in the next week's special election. And conservative radio hosts are calling that a stab in the back.
Yes. There's this disconnect between what the president says and what the president actually does. John McCain makes this point about the president a lot. So to your point, Donald Trump, the president, endorsed Luther Strange. He is the choice of the Republican establishment. He's the choice of Mitch McConnell for
He's serving right now.
That's right. And so Mo Brooks, who is sort of the outsider, the sort of who is more aligned politically with Donald Trump, probably is the favorite of the conservative wing of the party. And you have folks like Ann Coulter, no shortage of conservative commentators who were confused and really upset by the president's decision to do that, to weigh in on a race and do something like that really could be a game changer.
If McConnell's candidate, Luther Strange, loses, Chad, is that another nail in the coffin for McConnell's leadership in the Senate?
Potentially. But again, you know, Republicans, you know, tend to back their own here. But also it's a question of how this reflects the president. You know, he went out on a limb to endorse someone in a very competitive primary. And you have to remember that this is the seat vacated by Jeff Sessions, the attorney general. And so you have that dynamic at play here, too. what this race signifies next week, it brings to light the schisms that are inside the Republican Party, even among very conservative factions. You've had, Mo Brooks, the conservative congressman. He has tried to, to tie himself to President Trump. You've had Luther Strange doing the same thing. And then you have Judge Roy Moore, the former Supreme Court justice in Alabama, who some people argue is more conservative than any of them. I mean, this is really a fractured situation here.
That's Chad Pergram, who covers Congress for Fox News, and Jeff Bennett, who covers the White House for NPR. Now, used to cover Congress, has been sent down the other side of Pennsylvania Avenue to cover.
Come back and visit us sometime.
I will.
Thanks to both of you.
Sure thing. Take care.
C to the O, to the O, to the ball, to the spoon. Ball to the spoon, to the mouth of the boy in the room. Room for that goodness inside the bloom.
It's here and now.
Good goes around and around and around. C to the O, to the O on that table for two.
Music there from the new TV commercial for Cheerios cereal. The spot's called Good Goes Round, and the music originated with hip-hop artist Latrell James.
C to the O, to the O on the first day of school. Schooling your sister on why and just how to be cool.
James put a sunny, feel-good swing into the Cheerios spot, but it's the tracks from his other work that's really worth listening to. They're songs about the reality of his life and experience growing up in the Dorchester neighborhood of Boston, and those songs carry gravitas and poetry in each jam-packed rhyme. I spoke with Latrell James recently, and I asked him how he became the new voice for Cheerios.
Having friends. That's the best way to put it. Yeah, I have friends. And it's just really just a big thank you to Brian from Gratitude Sounds, which is a company in Boston that focuses on licensing music for commercials and television. So thank you, Brian.
That's how the connection was made?
Absolutely.
Do you think hope is going to open a lot more doors for you?
Absolutely. I mean, anytime you can have somebody's voice and people like a song that a particular person's attached to, and they can hear that all over the world. People are curious of who that person is and what else they have to offer. So, like, it's definitely helped me. And I mean, I like social media wise, you can see that. Mm-hmm. Play wise on my SoundCloud, you can see that. It's pretty cool.
Has anyone said, I just got to ask this,
Has anyone said,
you're selling out?
No.
Okay.
I mean, I would never see it as selling out because, I mean, like today, like a stream is worth less than a penny and artists need other revenue streams to make money. Like no artist is out here making all their money directly from their music anymore. They're selling merchandise, they're doing tours, and they're partnering up with corporations a la Chance the Rapper, a la Pusha T. These guys have done commercials with Kit Kat. I just seen Chance on a Twitter commercial, which is pretty crazy. So, like, and Pusha T was on McDonald's,
right?
Those are big things. And even back then, in the 90s, I can recall Biggie Smalls on a St. Ives commercial. And I can recall who else had a St. Ives commercial, like a beer company. Like, these are things that you see. I mean, artists need other ways to make their money. So,
absolutely a fair point. You know, since you mentioned Chance the Rapper and Pusha T, what do you think it is about hip hop that makes it such a great voice or, part of ad campaigns for huge companies? Why do you think they're doing that?
Hip hop has its thumb on the pulse of the youth.
Yeah.
And that's just what it is. It's a youth-driven market. And not only is it just youth-driven, it's connected. It's connected all of the ages from back with KRS-One to even now. So, like, those people still listen to this music. It's a growing pond of people who love hip-hop. And, like, that's one of the coolest things out here. It's ever-changing. There's a new star every 2 years. Like, who wouldn't want to be a part of hip-hop?
So we talked about Cheerios. We got that out of the way. Let's talk about your other music.
Absolutely.
And I'd love to have you play some for us. How about Beautiful Day?
Sure. Yeah. Look, woke up my inner demon, an angel with plans of scheming. Trouble season while your pastor is beaming, gleaming. Pistol squeezing, then relieve you of expensive sneakers. The stamp receiving, everybody got that diabetes. sugar levels and movie theater shootings. They raised the marathon in the city of Lord. Massachusetts, the streets are flooded with students. Some of them lack class, ironic, most of them stupid. And the ones who ain't pursue it, ride around in that Buick. And the mentality, they own everything you get. So your jewelry's useless, security's useless. People die every day, how we gonna be immune to it, huh? Possessed brothers with weapons in their possession. Get exercise in facilities of correction. Serves aid and come out with all this aggression. Then repeats the same thing, cause nobody hires a felon, Then lines of what isn't important. Skip lines of employment and jump in lines for Jordans. These lines distorted, some lines were snorted. Lines that shouldn't be crossed, enemies back and forth. It means nothing if it doesn't make you happy. Peer pressure lands you in the pack of patty. Had to follow choice, follow suit, or follow your voice. Get your education and forever owe your Auntie Sally. Good morning. Good morning. Get your education and forever. I said, had to follow choice, follow suit, or follow your voice. Get your education.
That was cool. That was Latrell James performing his song, Beautiful Day.
See.
Right here in the studio. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So that song, it's got some love, some honest love.
Absolutely.
For Massachusetts and for Boston. So many lines that we could talk about, like Massachusetts, the streets are flooded with students. Some of them lack class.
Mm-hmm.
Ironic, most of them stupid.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me about Beautiful Day.
It's a song I wrote because it's the total opposite of what the title is. And I think that like we all wake up and say it's a beautiful day outside, but there's a lot of truth amongst people just walking around the city, amongst truth amongst myself. So like I just want to reflect about the honest side of things. Particularly that line is just a reflection of, you know, like I felt like when I went to college and had no clue of what I wanted to do. I only went because my peers were going. And I felt like, you know, that's a stupid decision. You should go when you know what you want to do and pursue and not go just to go. So that's where I know, like, I know a lot of my peers felt the same way, too. So that's where that line comes from.
Well, and then you also talk about people not being able to get jobs because they'd been formerly incarcerated.
Mm-hmm.
So
possessed brothers with weapons in their possession. Get exercise in facilities of correction. Serves aid and come out with all the aggression and repeats the same thing because nobody hires a felon. It's the truth.
Yeah.
That's literally the cycle. And it happens a lot in urban communities in Boston. So, like, I'm just going to tell you the ugly truth and you have to accept it over such a pretty beat.
So tell me more about how you grew up in Dorchester.
See.
Yeah. So tell me, how did that influence what's in your music now?
It's amazing because Dorchester is so diverse. I mean, like going down towards Bowdoin Street, Cape Verdean community is huge. And then you go down to Geneva Ave and around Dorchester Ave, the Vietnamese community is huge. And then you can also take Dorchester Ave straight into Mass Ave, which leads to some of the biggest universities in the world. Like you get to see some of the toughest streets at the same time. And you can literally take a bus and get to one of the most prestigious colleges in the world. So like when you get that dichotomy, it affects you.
Mm-hmm.
It affects you a lot. And that's where my music is.
So tell me more about how it affected you.
Me in particular? I mean, like, it was strange because I have five other siblings besides myself. So, like, I didn't grow up getting everything I wanted, but I also got to see, like, you know, you don't need everything you want to be happy. I was in an apartment and then right next to me, like, Dorchester's weird. You can be in an apartment and your best friend could be in, like, one of the best houses in the world. Like, and it's like, wow, your house is beautiful. Like, there's just that much difference in class. Those things literally shape me because I know the difference between, like, that didn't change. It doesn't matter if you're in that situation, if you're going to private schools or not. Like, a human is a human. That's why I look at everything now. It's like, all right, that's a human being. They can be going to the most prestigious school in the world. They can have all of this. But, like, you're a human because you live next door to me.
Yeah. Now, I've heard that you've said it in the past that you want to be the greatest rapper. I still think that's entirely possible. But that now maybe you just want to be a great influence. Also possible. So, but what kind of influence is it that you want to have?
That's great research there. Sheesh, I don't remember when I even said that, but I did say that at one point. That's very true. at one time, you know, it was always, hey, I just want to, like, Jay-Z is my favorite rapper. It's like, I just want to be better than Jay-Z. But then when you look back at it, I'm like, do I want to be like Jay-Z, or do I want to influence people the way Jay-Z did? And even more so for me, I'm like super involved in my community. So like, I want to always give back. And maybe I'm not the greatest rapper, but maybe I inspire the greatest rapper, or maybe I end up producing and helping that the next greatest producer become great, because like, we're given tools, and I feel like we should share our tools, our knowledge with people. So like, that's when I say influence. I don't want to be the biggest rapper anymore, because being the biggest rapper comes with a lot of craziness.
Well put. I have to say, though, just hearing you and watching you perform here, your music has the power to put people right in the middle of your experience.
That's what I try.
Well, Latrell, I'm going to be a bit greedy here and have us listen to one more of your songs. This one is off your album 12, and it's called Distance. But Latrell, first of all, tell us, what's it about?
My gosh, separating yourself from people that's holding you back. That's really the whole, and that's whether it's family, friends, business associates. It was just more so inspired by watching my little brother grow, and like, he's a musician as well, and like, he's been doing really amazing things, but it was like a point where he was trying to like, hey, am I going to pursue school or pursue music? And like, this was basically my open letter to him, like, hey, you have a choice.
All right, well, let's hear it.
Sure.
This is Distance.
Am I wrong to tell my little brother follow his dreams? How we gonna fail when his friends get that college degree? Probably like me, got a semester to go, and I don't plan on going back. It don't connect with my goals. Most doubted out of my class, I'm the victorious one. Differences, they cross the stages, I'm performing on them. They ain't think sitting in classrooms was torturing him. Music was the only thing that was important to him. Arguing with my girl, she want a kid in the house, but I don't fit in that equation, she ain't figured it out. My occupation is in applications, filling them out. Sometimes making you want.
Latrell James is a musician based in Boston. We've got more information about him at hereandnow.org. This is Here and Now.
Tying my belt, doing this for myself. Don't you ever interfere with my zone.
New Orleans is bracing for more rain this weekend after last weekend's torrential rains caused severe flooding and the city's pumping system had multiple failures. New Orleans Mayor Mitch Landrieu held a press conference this morning to reassure residents that a water pumping turbine that caught fire on Wednesday has been repaired and is now being tested.
There is no need, as I have said many times, for panic. In the abundance of caution, and in the spirit of transparency, I think it's important for the people to know where we are.
Both Landrieu and Louisiana Governor John Bel Edwards have declared states of emergency. And joining us now is Tegan Wendland from WWNO in New Orleans. Tegan, first of all, what does it look like there today? What are the streets like?
Well, today, I mean, we're having pretty nice weather and the streets are clear, but we are expecting a little bit of rain through tonight and into the weekend. So schools are closed again today. They were as well yesterday. And people are out filling sandbags to protect their homes. They're out there filling their sandbags in the sun. So it's kind of a strange sight.
So there's no flooding left on the streets at this point?
No, not at all.
Now, Mayor Landrieu told people that the turbine that caught fire on Wednesday and which powers the pumps is repaired. Let's listen to a little more of what he said.
What is clear to me today is that we remain at risk, I believe, if a major storm comes until we get additional turbines back up, which we expect by the end of this month. And, of course, we have been aggressively trying to do that, and we're going to double our efforts as well.
Now, first of all, there were new pumps put in after Hurricane Katrina by the Army Corps of Engineers, but the pumps we're talking about here are not those pumps, right?
Well, we're really juggling two sets of malfunctions here. There are these big pumps to get water out of the city, and then there are power generators that run them, and we've had problems with both. So today we've got one generator of five working. We're waiting to get another one back up and running. So that's two generators, and the city also ordered several more, but we're waiting for them to come in. But even with all that power, there are still a bunch of pumps offline. There were 16 that were down during the storm last weekend, and there are 121 total.
And the mayor is calling for the resignation of four top officials. What does he think people did wrong in this case?
So As the rain fell this weekend and really inundated parts of the city, the Sewerage and Water Board, which is the agency responsible for drainage, repeatedly stated that all of these pumps were up and running. And then it turned out that, in fact, 16 of them were down. So the mayor called for the firing and resignation of employees at both the Sewerage and Water Board and the Department of Public Works. Some board members also resigned because he really said they lied to the public. The mayor's worked hard to pioneer this collaboration between these two disparate agencies. It's kind of wonky here because one of them is responsible for maintenance and the other for construction projects. But this whole thing really raises questions as to whether they're working well together.
So Tegan, what's in the forecast? Is more rain on the way?
Yes, we're expecting a bit today and up to a few inches over the weekend. It's not a lot of rain, but you know the city has really tried to make amends for the communications problems last weekend by holding lots of press conferences for every development this week. Some days there were four press conferences updating people on the latest. And so it seems that both the city and residents are taking an abundance of caution on this. And that's why you see people out filling sandbags in the sun to take home and try to protect their homes this weekend.
That's Tegan Wendland at WWNO in New Orleans. Tegan, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
President Trump told reporters yesterday that he's doing the military a favor by banning transgender people from serving.
As you know, it's been a very complicated issue for the military. It's been a very confusing issue for the military. And I think I'm doing the military a great favor.
The president announced his ban of transgender troops in tweets last month, citing medical costs and disruption. But so far, his ban has not been enforced. Meanwhile, two advocacy groups have filed the first federal lawsuit against the ban. GLBTQ Legal Advocates and Defenders, or GLAAD, and the National Center for Lesbian Rights filed Doe versus Trump Wednesday in the U.S. District Court of Washington, D.C., on behalf of five active service members, all transgender women. Joining us now is one of the lawyers on the case, Jennifer Levi. She is also director of GLAAD's Transgender Rights Project. Jennifer, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you so much.
First of all, just tell us more about the transgender women you are representing in this case. Who are they and why did they decide to bring this lawsuit?
Yeah, sure. So I represent five transgender members of the military. They are all decorated soldiers. They have experience that ranges from 3 years in the service to upwards of 20 years in the service. They have courageously defended this country, been in active service, including in Afghanistan, Iraq, Korea, and beyond. And they brought this case because of the president's announcement that he would deny transgender people the ability to serve their country.
And so what is the claim that they and you are making, that their rights are being violated here?
Yeah, you know, there's really two central claims. One is absolutely that their rights are being violated, that the action to reverse the policy that allows transgender people to openly serve is discrimination based on who they are. And there's really a second important central claim, which is that the military created the right of continued service by announcing in June of 2016 that if service members came out as transgender, they would be permitted to serve. And so this is really the only time in history that I know of where there's been a group of individuals who have been told that they could serve, who were then told that they could not.
Well, so your case rests on a couple of critical factors here. One is the assertion that President Trump's tweets equate to actual policy. And I mean, I don't think there's necessarily any solid agreement on that. I mean, is that what you're saying, that as soon as the president issued those tweets, that it constituted an infringement of the rights of these members of the military?
No, that's not the basis of the case.
Okay.
The tweets were the announcement of the policy, but there have been public reports that the White House General Counsel has already signed off on a plan of implementation to exclude transgender service members. And the White House has not only not denied that, they have repeatedly confirmed the fact that the White House is moving forward to implement the policy. And so there's really much more to this case than tweets at this point.
Well, so let me ask you about that, because the Defense Department, though, has said that it would only enforce the ban when the policy was formally implemented. It hasn't yet been implemented. So how can you prove harm when the policy isn't enacted?
Well, you know, these service members are facing harm right now. They have immediate decisions to make about re-enlistment, about housing, about providing for their families, about future service. And so, you know, their lives have really been upended by the president's announcement of this change in policy.
You know, it's interesting because I'm seeing that there are some legal scholars who are looking at this case and saying that it just in and of the existence of the case in and of itself puts the government in kind of a tricky position, right? Because federal courts can't render judgment in a case unless it's quote unquote ripe, right? That's rooted in present controversy. So if the government says there's no present controversy, if they allege that, then perhaps they're also alleging that the process by which the president's tweets and how the White House is handling this doesn't constitute actual policymaking.
Well, there's really no end to this suit short of the government confirming that transgender service members can continue to serve openly. If they say anything other than that, then it really demonstrates that they are moving forward with a change in policy. So, you know, it's an important case for these service members because they need to know what the current policy is of continued service. And you're right that the case forces the government to answer that question.
Well, Jennifer Levi is director of GLAAD's Transgender Rights Project. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you.
Dementia sufferers may lose many of their cognitive abilities, but they do not lose the fundamental human desire for physical intimacy. And as Kathy Ritchie from Here and Now contributor KJZZ in Phoenix discovered, fostering that intimacy can be good medicine.
And that's my son and his two girls. And this is my friend, Martin, and us, and
photographs dot the walls of Lori Thomas's cozy little room at Huger Mercy Living Center, an assisted living facility in Northwest Phoenix. She has frontotemporal degeneration, a type of dementia. These pictures are her connections to a fading past. They're mostly of her kids and grandkids, and then there's Martin. Martin was Thomas's longtime companion. When she came to Huger Mercy in 2015, he went to live with his family in another state. Denise Gutierrez is Thomas's daughter.
And so I never wanted to say, you're never going to see your spouse again. I would say, you know, when he gets better, he's coming back.
Gutierrez says it was a sad time for her mother, but then she met someone.
One day I came in and they were just sitting on the bed holding hands and my mother was elated and she said, look who came back.
Gutierrez says the gentleman her mother was holding hands with looked just like her former companion. He had the same build, even used the same walker. His family knows about his relationship with Thomas, and they're okay with it. So does the staff at Huger Mercy.
People think of intimacy, immediately jump right to sexual intercourse, and that could be included. But we have to think of intimacy, we think of it as relationships.
Lisa O'Toole is a manager at Huger Mercy.
Part of the disease process is that unlearning. So we're not thinking as we would usually as an adult, but we kind of unlearn to the point that we're almost childlike, that this is my best friend and I connect with you. Honestly, we encourage it.
Karen Shannon's husband, Matthew, has Alzheimer's disease. He also came to Huger Mercy in 2015. For Shannon, placing her husband was painful. She felt guilty. Then,
one day I came to visit with Matthew and Tom was there. And the two of them were chatting, and I chatted with them for a while. And suddenly, they got up and left me sitting there, and they went on their little walk, you know. So I'm sitting there by myself. I can't tell you. The expression is, for me, is my heart was full of joy.
Intimacy is something we all need, from the moment we're born to the moment we die, says Marianne McCarthy, a geriatric and psychiatric nurse practitioner at Huger, and that doesn't change even with a dementia diagnosis.
People tend not to touch people as they get older, and I find that older adults, and especially those who are in different facilities, are like starving, you know, for intimacy.
Which could explain how someone's behavior could be misconstrued as being sexually inappropriate.
So that term sexually inappropriate makes me just a little bit crazy because we're defining things as inappropriate based on whatever, you know, whether they're our puritanical values or just the whole idea that women become neutered when we get older. You know, men, if they're sexual beings, they're thought of as dirty old men.
To illustrate her point, McCarthy talks about the one time she was called to another facility to evaluate an 87-year-old man who had dementia and was in a wheelchair with an amputated leg.
I remember going back out to staff. I said, really? You know, what did you want me to do with this gentleman? What do you think should happen with this gentleman? And what was it that he was doing? And all he was doing was, he was flirting.
That said, some cases do require interventions like psychotropic drugs or even relocation to another facility. But going back to McCarthy's example, it does speak to the need for more, well, sex ed. Michelle Gregaitis-Reyes is a family nurse practitioner at Banner Alzheimer's Institute in Phoenix. She says truly inappropriate sexual behavior occurs in about 15% of people with dementia. And in her experience, most facilities nationwide aren't teaching staff how to interpret what is and isn't sexually inappropriate behavior.
For example, disrobing. Disrobing can be caused by so many triggers that have nothing whatsoever to do with sexual activity or intent.
Rather, that person could need to use the bathroom, they might be wearing uncomfortable clothing, or have a medical condition like a UTI. In general, says Gregaitis-Reyes, most people, including those with dementia, simply need human connection. For Here and Now, I'm Kathy Ritchie in Phoenix.
Netflix announced this week that David Letterman is returning to television with a 6-episode series premiering next year. The streaming service is on a roll right now, releasing 7 new shows in the past few weeks, including Ozark, a drama that tells the story of a money laundering scheme gone wrong. Jason Bateman of Arrested Development fame plays Marty Bird, a financial planner who gets mixed up with a Mexican drug cartel and puts his family in danger. Here's a clip from the first episode.
Hypothetically, scale of 1 to 10, how difficult would it be for someone to disappear?
New ID, social security numbers, credit cards, you could do it. For a while, anyway. Really depends on who's looking for you and how much money they have.
Hang on. I just got a text from my bank. My wife emptied our checkings and savings.
NPR TV critic Eric Deggans has been binge-watching Netflix and joins us now. Eric, 7 new shows in the past few weeks?
I'm exhausted.
Too many shows, but are they good?
Well, I think that may be part of the problem for Netflix is that some of the shows are good, but some are not. Now, Ozark is a great example because this is a show that is really good, and word about how good it is starting to build. But I think part of the problem this year is that you have a show, for example, like Glow, a really great story about the start of a female wrestling league. And then the very next week, a show called Gypsy comes out with Naomi Watts that's terrible. And it kind of kills the momentum of both shows because people are so busy talking about how Gypsy's terrible. And then another show comes out called Friends from College with Keegan-Michael Key that's also kind of mediocre. And so Ozark comes out, and a lot of people didn't even realize it was out. I was in Los Angeles talking to people from the TV industry, and they hadn't really heard about this show. But buzz is starting to build finally, and I think it's going to be recognized eventually. It's just going to take some time for the word to get out.
Well, tell us more about the show Ozark and Marty Bird, who we heard from there in the introduction. How does he end up in that bind that he's in?
Yeah. So Jason Bateman's protagonist is a really interesting character. When we meet him as the show begins, he seems to be this very buttoned-down financial planner. His firm is obviously making money, but he's not spending it. He lives in a very modest home. And what we find out eventually is that he's actually his firm is laundering drug money for a Mexican drug cartel. And we have a clip where the person who runs the drug cartel, who's played by Isai Morales, is pressuring Marty to do more money laundering because he's found out that Marty's partner has stolen some money. So let's check it out.
Now, I want you to take my $7,973,000 with you to Missouri and clean it.
Clean it?
Mm-hmm.
So see, Marty's partner had stolen $7 million from this guy. So Marty comes up with the $7 million, almost all the money he has, and gives it to him. And the guy says, if you can clean this money for me, I will let you live. And so Marty and his family have to move from Chicago to the Ozarks. It's very well done.
So what about the newest Netflix show that people are talking about and that we learned about this week? And that is David Letterman is going to be back with a new Netflix show. Do you know much about it? Like, do you think it'll be good?
Well, the big unanswered question, of course, is he going to have the beard? upset.
He does look like Santa Claus in the pictures.
Yeah. That beard is pretty much like a whole other character. But basically, we don't know much about it. We think it's going to be an interview show. And it could be really compelling. I mean, you know, David Letterman, when he was really good at interviewing, when he was interested in interviewing someone, he was one of the best interviewers on television. And so I can't wait to see him do a show where he only talks to the people he's interested in talking to. And frankly, it's the kind of thing that a lot of people, including myself, said he should do when he left CBS, that he should do something online where he just talked to the people he wanted to talk to, because that's when he's at his best.
You know, my childhood dream was to go see David Letterman on The Late Show live at the Ed Sullivan Theater, and I never did it. Because when I first wanted to do it, I wasn't old enough to get in. And then I got busy.
Well, I was lucky enough to do it twice. I went the second week that he was at the Ed Sullivan Theater when I was a journalist working for a New Jersey paper. And I went to the week before he stopped doing it. He did an interview with NPR. He talked to us, and I was able to watch him do his show with Howard Stern and Don Rickles, and then he talked with us for about a half an hour. And so it's one of the highlights of my career, I have to say, because he really set the standard for the modern way that we see television talk shows in late night talk about their subjects, structure their shows, handle comedy. Him much more so, I think, than Jay Leno. And now to see him move in this space in Netflix, I'm just hoping that he takes it seriously enough to really bring some of that innovation to the streaming space.
That's NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Eric, thanks so much as always.
Always a pleasure.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Agnetha Chakrabarty.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.